Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm happy to say we have Charles McKinney on the show, and we'll be talking about his book, Greater Freedom, The Evolution of the Civil Rights Struggle in Wilson, North Carolina. When I was an undergraduate oh so many years ago, it seemed that there was a list of books that one had to read in order to graduate. And those books included things like Plato's Republic and Rousseau's Social Contract and Freud's Civilization and Its Discontent, that sort of thing. But there was one book on this list that always stood out for me, and that was William Sheridan Allen's Nazi Seizure of Power, The Experience of a Single German Town, 1922 to 1945. This book, unlike the others, was a history book. And it told a rather sad story. It was a story of how a group of people, Germans in this case, in a small town, made the decision to support Nazism and all that followed from that. And it gave us a new insight into the appeal of the Nazi movement. Well, Charles McKinney has written a book that is similar in a way. It is what is sometimes called a microhistory. I don't particularly like that term, but it's a local history of a town in North Carolina, Wilson, and the struggle of African Americans there for what he calls greater freedom. And it's really a long struggle, and it's really a story of the long civil rights movement, because Charles begins the story in the 1930s, long before most people would consider the civil rights movement to have begun, and he takes it all the way through the present. And he introduces you to the people, the actual people, the individuals who work towards gaining civil rights for African Americans. And he talks, of course, about the whites who were involved as well and how they tried to fight and accommodate and negotiate with the African American activists. What's really terrific about this book is that, again, it puts a broad national event in a kind of local focus so that you actually get to see how it worked outside of any abstractions. Who knew whom? Who could influence whom? What organizations were involved? Who had the money? Who was on the city council? The kind of thing that you need in order to understand why anything happens on the local level. And we should always remember, just like politics, almost all history is local. So kind of hope that Charles's book will be read widely, like William Sheridan Allen's book. I enjoyed talking with him today, and I think that you'll enjoy the interview. So without further delay, here it is. Hi, Charles.
Hello, Marshall.
How are you today?
Doing all right. How about yourself?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for asking. Today we have Charles McKinney on the show, and we'll be talking about his terrific book, Greater Freedom, The Evolution of the Civil Rights Struggle in Wilson, North Carolina. I have read this book, and I can tell you that it is the product of long and hard labors. It is very rewarding to read. It is what is sometimes called, I don't particularly like this word myself, I guess microhistory or local history. I just think of it as history.
Right.
But yeah, this is the history of a community, and it's the attempts to kind of move into an era of greater freedom and greater civil rights. And one thing that's really terrific about the book is there are actually people in it. There are personalities. You actually get to see who did what on the local level. And it reminded me of going to city council meetings here in Iowa City. I recognize some of these characters, Charles. I know some of these people. They're doing different things now, but I recognize these people from the city council meetings. So it's a terrific book, and I hope people go out and read it. Charles, why don't you help us begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, I was born in Jefferson City, Missouri, and spent the first 6 years of my life there. My father worked at Lincoln University there in Jeff City. At the age of six, we moved out to Santa Barbara, California, and so I stayed out in California until high school, and then went to college at Morehouse College in Atlanta. I was as a Californian, basically. I was dead set on going to UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
Go Bruins! You know, down with the Trojans. I still hate the Trojans to this day. No offense to those Trojan listeners out there. I wound up at Morehouse. I got a scholarship to Morehouse, and it was a transformative experience. It allowed me to achieve my highest academic potential, and it put me in touch with so many networks, Southern networks, particularly intellectual and academic networks, and so I was seriously challenged and given an opportunity to explore freedom struggles throughout the American South. Mm-hmm. The first history class I took, we'd read William Chafe's Civilities and Civil Rights. My advisor at Morehouse, Marcellus Barksdale, was also a Duke graduate. He went to grad school at Duke. He was the second African-American to get his PhD in the history department in 1977. Wow. Something like that. And so I took his class, and I was on local civil rights movements, and I was hooked. And Morehouse provided me an opportunity to really explore in a substantive way social change movements, not only in Atlanta, but throughout the region as I immersed myself in the major. So, mm-hmm. So Morehouse for 4 years, graduating in 1989. And then I taught elementary school for a year back out in Los Angeles, third grade at Ralph Bunch Elementary School. I knew I wasn't going straight into graduate school, but by the end of that year, I was I couldn't wait to get back to school. it was a humbling and searing experience, Marsh. Teaching third grade.
Yeah, I bet.
My first day of class, I had 47 students.
Yeah.
And budget cuts and, you know, teacher migrations and all this other stuff. So we had a lot of recess that first week. A lot of recess. And so so after a year of teaching elementary school, and I went to graduate school started graduate school at Duke, and got my master's, and then left school for a number of years. Left school for about 5 years after getting my master's in 93. Worked in the nonprofit sector. Worked for an AmeriCorps program called Public Allies, leadership development program for young people between the ages of 18 and 30. Did that for a number of years. Worked for a juvenile diversion program. And rediscovered my reasons for wanting to finish graduate school. One of my major problems was I sort of felt like I was a cheerleader, sort of watching a really important game taking place and not participating. Mm-hmm. I was writing about inequality, and I was writing about freedom struggles and freedom movements, but I was living in Durham in the early '90s, mid '90s, There were a number of challenges that were facing poor and working class communities, and so I felt like I needed to be a little more connected to those realities. And so I spent a little time in the nonprofit sector, discovered and I guess re-realized that that going to graduate school and attaining a graduate degree is not necessarily incompatible with trying to find an ability to express concern or support for for particular sorts of movements and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. So I went back to graduate school and wound up working with Bill Chafe, who was also my mm-hmm. mentor's advisor at Duke, and also Charles Payne, who had written a wonderful book, I've Got the Light of Freedom, that came out in 93 or 94. Larry Goodwin and Ray Gavins and William Turner and C. Eric Lincoln. And it's just a coterie of scholars who really blazed a trail and really worked me over when I went back to school. So I finished Duke in 2003, did a postdoc in the African American Studies program there, and then lucked up and got this job here at Rhodes College, where I'm now an associate professor.
Mm, wow. Well, congratulations on that. This isn't about history so much, but I feel compelled to ask, what was it like moving from LA to an all African American environment at Morehouse? For those people who are listening internationally, Morehouse is one of the many historically black colleges and universities in the United States. And I just kind of wonder what that must have been like to be an LA kid and then move into that environment.
Well, it was even more extreme than that, Marshall. I was a Santa Barbara.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You know,
right.
An LA kid would have had a slightly different experience mm-hmm. than me. I was a Santa Barbara kid, and I used to joke all the time that when my family left town, the percentage of African Americans would decrease substantially. If we left town for the summer, they would have to. I felt like they should have been compelled to change the population number on the sign when the four of us left, there was like a 3% drop in the African American population. So, you know, and so my parents, the summer of my junior year, they told me, look, you know, And I love them to this day for this. They said, look, you can go to school anywhere you want, but there's a number of schools out there that you have not been exposed to. And both of my parents were graduates of historically black colleges, University of Arkansas at Pine Bluff in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. And so they took me on a black college tour the summer of my junior year. So we went to Texas Southern. I went to Grambling, went to Tuskegee, and the tour culminated with Morehouse. Mm-hmm. And to be in that environment, to be at a school where, you know, where everybody looked like I did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is in the mid-80s, mid to late 80s, and, you know, affirmative action and, you know, the conversations and debates and arguments about diversity and affirmative action programming and things of this nature were really starting to sort of flare mm-hmm. up. And so what appealed to me about going to a place like Morehouse was all of that stuff was going to be off the table for me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You didn't have to worry about it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I you know, at no point in time was I going to go into class and somebody was going to assume that I was taking somebody else's place.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? Because of a quota.
I hadn't thought about that.
You know, and so that was appealing to me. And I'd never had, in 12 years of formal education, I'd had exactly one African-American teacher. And that was my music teacher in high school. And so, you know, so to go to Morehouse, to go down to an institution that was crafted specifically to educate me was a very compelling experience. And so after that summer tour, I was like, yeah, I think that's where I'm going. So instead of going to UCLA, I'm going to go to Morehouse because the folks down here are you know, my success, my intellectual odyssey, my intellectual journeys, it's their number one priority.
Uh-huh.
Right? And so many of the things, so many of the factors and ingredients that complicate that odyssey were taken off the table for me. Now, let's be clear. This wasn't heaven.
Right.
Right. So, you know, there's always challenges, a range of challenges in terms of, you know, college life and trying to figure out how to navigate those challenges. And so, you know, in many respects, my experience wasn't that different from a lot of other folks' experience. But I know for me, Morehouse was a place that, as a friend of mine, again, said that it was going to allow me to reach my highest academic potential. And hopefully that's what I did. I like to think that's what I did.
I think you did. Yeah. No, that's a terrific story. It doesn't translate very well on the radio, but I'm smiling. Yeah, it really sounds like a terrific. So I had an experience like that. Obviously, it didn't involve the same factors. In college, I went to a liberal arts college in Iowa, and it was a really mind-blowing experience for me, and it's truly, truly transformative. But I'll tell you what, I'm pretty sure that after this interview is posted and people hear it, that you're going to get a call from Morehouse. They're going to ask you to come speak or something, and
I certainly hope so.
Yeah, because you're a great advocate for the place, and I just find it very interesting. It's a part of American life that I don't think many of the listeners to this show are from elsewhere. I don't think they know a lot about it, and I think when they hear about it, they kind of cock their head. But
right.
Because it's a kind of a weird thing in a way. But you know, hearing you talk about it so eloquently and positively is a It makes me proud to be an American. What can I say? I really does.
It's the existence of these institutions and the continued existence of historically black colleges and universities. I talk about the existence of these institutions and other all black institutions to really sort of complicate the narrative we have around civil rights and inequality and things of that nature. In American society, right?
So there is a
dynamic tension between the existence of these sorts of colleges and the perceived notions of colorblindness and inequality and things of that nature. So those are always very rich conversations. And I'm always quick to remind people that there's a huge difference between between historically black colleges and universities now and the reality of all white institutions back in the early part of the 20th century, right? Segregation. I mean, it was illegal for my parents to attend the University of Arkansas, at Little Rock, in the in the first third of the 20th century, right? Mm-hmm. That was a violation of state law, right? Mm-hmm. It just could not happen.
Yeah.
Whereas there are no legal restrictions stopping anybody from attending an historically black college or university.
Yep.
Right. And so, which leads to another set of
very interesting
questions, yep. Right? It's always fun to.
Yeah, it's a cool thing. It's a cool thing, and it's really interesting. Thanks. I know it's a kind of a digression from the main topic, which we're going to get to right now, but thank you for speaking about that. So tell us how you came to write this book.
Well, again, as a grad student at Duke, Duke is one of the epicenters, along with UNC, Chapel Hill, and a few other places. Duke was one of the major epicenters in the late 80s and early 90s, where there was an increasing focus and interest on local studies, on community studies, and the need and the urgency of creating these community studies was really felt. And I'd already, in coming in, I knew that I was going to be very interested in trying to find a particular community to study. And again, the arc, the trajectory of historical scholarship. We were still pretty much laboring under what Julian Bond and others have called a master narrative of the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
That this top down narrative that Martin King and Lyndon Johnson and the NAACP crafted civil rights policy, and everybody else was just sort of soldiers in this glorious battle who were following orders. And it's very, very uncomplicated, very simple, a little too uncomplicated, a little too simple, and not quite accurate. And so I knew I wanted to do a local study. In the initial iteration of this project, I was going to do a comparative study. And so I was thinking, okay, I want to do something in Eastern North Carolina, which is pretty under-researched, and maybe something in the Piedmont. And then the Piedmont sort of dropped away because I became more and more interested in what was going on out in Eastern North Carolina. Again, a relatively under-researched portion of the state. And so, when I started knocking around in Wilson, I bumped into some pretty interesting stuff. I bumped into some interesting people and some dynamics that caught my attention. And so, this book is a pared down, hopefully better version of the dissertation that I turned in 2003 about Wilson, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Well, begin by telling us about Wilson. What do they do there? Who lived there? Who
sure.
lives there now? That kind of thing. Because I've never been there, I confess.
Right.
Well, maybe I'll go. I don't know.
Yeah, well, maybe so. Maybe so. If I do this right, the Wilson Chamber of Commerce will
they'll invite you too. You go on a speaking tour.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. So one of the first things you need to know about Wilson was that in there, for most of the 20th century, Wilson was the number one producer of bright leaf tobacco in the world. And so what that means was that just about 80% of people who are working in the farm, who are working on farms or working in agriculture, are working in tobacco. Black tenant farmers as well as white tenant farmers, and so that fact shapes a lot of the social and economic and political terrain. People in Wilson, a critical mass of the population of Wilson County, is tied to the land in some way, shape, or form. They are tied or connected to tobacco. So if they're not picking tobacco, they are working in the warehouses where they are processing the tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
They're working to store, to smoke and cure the tobacco. They're working on, they're working in auction houses. Wilson used to be packed before automation and new technology sort of ravaged the industry, packed with warehouses and auction houses and things of this nature. And so that's sort of the first. That's one of the first facts about Wilson County. And 40% of the county is African American. And so of that 40%, again, a large contingent, a majority of them are tied. Majority of those folks are tied to the land, and so what that meant for me as a person who was going to school back in the day in North Carolina. North Carolina's got a reputation as one of the more moderate southern states. Bill Chafe's book on civilities and civil rights about Greensboro and Christina Green's work in on Durham, Durham, North Carolina, and other works on other cities really sort of nailed this down, right? That North Carolina is a moderate state, and because of this moderate political and economic and social climate, it was able to achieve a level of civil rights activism that we don't see in the lower South, right, where there's higher levels of violence, more economic marginalization, and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. So what I found in Wilson was that the dynamics, the social, economic, and political dynamics in eastern North Carolina were a lot more like the dynamics we saw in the Deep South, which presents a bit of a contradiction, mm-hmm. right? The moderate reputation that North Carolina acquires as a state is largely produced in the Piedmont, is largely produced in the major cities, in Charlotte and Raleigh and Durham. So this moderate notion, right, or this culture of civility falls away when we penetrate and analyze and really sort of observe eastern North Carolina. And so that was the dynamic that sort of set me on my way, right? How can a place like Wilson, that's got high levels of tenant farming, right? Eastern North Carolina is the portion of the state where the vast majority of slaves in the state were working. And again, Wilson County is located about 50 miles east of Raleigh. Mm-hmm. It is on the western edge of the Black Belt, where the vast majority of African Americans in the state live. Mm-hmm. And so African Americans are tenant farmers. They are tied to the land. Incidents of violence are higher in eastern North Carolina. Economic marginalization, again, sort of resembles that marginalization we see in the Deep South. It's harder to organize. The middle class that we see in major urban centers in North Carolina and across the South, that middle class is a fraction of its size, mm-hmm. in a place like Wilson. There isn't a phalanx of black lawyers. Mm-hmm. You know, there's one black lawyer. Yeah. There isn't yeah. a phalanx of black doctors. There's a smattering of doctors. There's a smattering of public school teachers, and without this cover from other elements of the black middle class, those teachers are even more sort of consigned to inaction in order to sort of preserve their jobs and their livelihood and things of that nature. And so it's the combination of these factors that led me to want to study Wilson in an in-depth way. And so one of the first stories that I bump into when I was doing my research and I started conducting oral interviews, and I interview Mark Sharp, a man who was in his late 80s at the time, early 90s. And one of the first things out of his mouth is he says, they lynched a Negro in Hoover time. Mm-hmm. And I ask him, could you talk to me about that a little bit? And so, you know, he tells me the story of Oliver Moore. Oliver Moore is charged with sexual assault. He's placed in a jail. 200 men, many of whom are wearing masks, come and allegedly overpower the deputy sheriff who is watching Mark Sharp, take Oliver Moore out of his jail cell, drive him into Wilson County, tie a rope around his shoulders, hoist him up into a tree, and shoot him over 200 times. And this was in 1930. And I use that story to talk about both Wilson's response to the incident as well as the state's response to the incident. Right, the governor of North Carolina at the time says, you know, this is a black mark against our state, and we're going to try to bring these people to justice. Meanwhile, in Wilson, this lynching is a spectacle lynching, right? So. After Moore's lynching, you start to see, his body is kept up for a couple of days, and people mm-hmm. come and congregate and start taking pictures and sort of hanging out. And And so these pictures are snapped as well. And so there's multiple interpretations of this. One interpretation in many of the white newspapers is, well, this is social control. This is justice. This is what happens when Negroes sort of step outside of their boundaries and step outside and enact in transgressive ways. In the black press, this was yet another example of how black life could be extinguished sort of casually, right? A person in the jail with Oliver Moore is able to identify a number of the folks who come and snatch Moore out of jail. Mm-hmm. And even with this positive identification, no charges are ever brought. The coroner's inquest is inconclusive. They don't declare this a murder. And so so there's no case effectively, right? And so this moment in time is seared into Mark Sharpe's mind. Mm-hmm. And one of the other reasons it's seared into his mind and the minds of a number of other people is that when they go into town, when they go into Wilson City, and into East Wilson, white proprietors of stores, the local shoemaker, the shoe shop, and the grocery store, they've cut out the picture of Oliver Moore's dead body and have placed that picture in the front window. Mm-hmm. And so when Mark Sharpe goes to the store with his mother, they see this image. Right, this image is placed in a number of shops and a number of windows. Right, and so that's a way of extending the atrocity. Right, that's a way that's a public declaration of black inferiority. It's a reminder that again, your life can be taken casually if you don't conform to the traditional tenets and notions of segregation, of white supremacy. And so that story, I tell that story in the introduction. And again, the juxtaposition here between the reality of life in Wilson for African Americans, how this lynching is used to make a public statement, to make a public declaration about the primacy of white supremacy. I contrast that story with the official line from Raleigh, the official line from the state capitol, which is, oh my goodness, a lynching, this is something that we can't tolerate. We have a history of moderate race relations here. We have good relations, and so this is out of the ordinary, right? Mm-hmm. This is anathema to what we believe. Mm-hmm. So it's a little more complicated than that, right? Mm-hmm. So then, as we move forward, I try to sort of lay out the terrain, economic terrain and cultural terrain in the late 30s and in late 30s and early 40s. The tobacco economy remains dominant. Yet and still, we see the African American civic universe in East Wilson, where African Americans overwhelmingly reside in the city of Wilson. We see this. We see the civic universe there, really sort of trying to make efforts to confront segregation. And this is an ongoing process, right? And I think Jacqueline Dowd Hall's work about the long civil rights movement is instructive, and that's one of the things that I sort of wanted to point out on this book, right? That this master narrative of the civil rights movement, that would have us believe that things really take off in 55 and come to a peak in 68. Much more complicated than that. Wilson's got a long history of struggle for greater freedom. African Americans form an independent school in 1918 when a black teacher is slapped by a white school administrator. Teachers quit their jobs and go on strike, and the community comes together and creates an independent elementary school apart from Wilson Public School System that remains in that stays open for a decade or so. And so there's a legacy both of racial violence, but also of self-help and aggressive. Aggressive responses to racial atrocities. So, coming into the story in the 1930s and 1940s, we see the civic universe of Wilson County trying to figure out how to make sense of something like, for instance, World War II. What does this war mean for us here, now? What does this war mean for our relationship to democracy, to equality? And you start to see and also you start to see a number of sort of diversified answers to this question. You see a nascent middle class activism rising, where you know, this coterie again of teachers and, you know, a small smattering of other professionals, morticians and preachers, a couple of doctors and folks like that are charting a path of what I of what other scholars have called racial diplomacy. This diplomacy between white elites, political and economic elites, to try to gain small concessions for the black community. Hey, we need a new community center. We need a new hospital. We need a new school. Going and asking for what they want and being given you know, a smattering of what they want. But we also see the construction of that portion of Wilson's African American civic universe. We see also a nascent struggle of working class, poor and working class African Americans, particularly those who are working in tobacco. We see increased union activity in the 1930s and 1940s. The CIO is active in the area, along with the AFL, trying to organize African American tobacco workers, and so we start to see their voices becoming more and more significant as we move forward. And so the traditional battlegrounds that we see in the larger civil rights narrative around voting rights and access to the quality education, we see those things playing out in Wilson as well. But the twist. The twist that I really appreciated in Wilson is that we see generally we tend to associate, you know, school integration and things of this nature with middle class activists. Well, in Wilson, it's working class folk living out in the rural areas, mm-hmm. who start to say, you know what, education stinks out here. We don't have a high school. Right, we don't have a middle school, and so what do we need to do in order to gain these things? And we don't necessarily want them. We don't want integrated schools. We want a school,
mm-hmm.
right? We're not pressed about integration, right? So in the late 40s, you see, you start to see in North Carolina and Wilson in particular, you start to see lawsuits where activists are suing for the construction of high schools that will service African American students. Again, they're ambivalent about integration. They're ambivalent about trying to create educational programming that's going to integrate black and white students. They say, no, we want a black high school. We want a black middle school. We want the high schools and middle schools and elementary schools that have already been built to be refurbished, to be reconstructed, to be brought up to code and things of this nature. And so working class activists are behind that push, and so middle class activists are sort of playing catch up in the late 40s and early 50s around the issue of school integration. Voting is obviously a very large concern. And so you see middle class folk, sort of pushing for the vote, pushing to get African American representation on the city council and things of that nature. And that happens in 1953 when G.K. Butterfield is elected to the city council. But this means different things for different people. For middle class activists, this is sort of a foot in the door, right? This is an opportunity for more formal representation for African Americans. For working class folk, they see this in a much more ambivalent light. They say, well, this is great. G.K. Butterfield, a dentist and World War I veteran, community activist. Congratulations, Dr. Butterfield. But our streets still aren't paved. our schools are still segregated. There's still higher levels of police brutality and racial racial violence and things of this nature. So, what are we going to do about that? Right. What's going to happen with these things? Right. And so, again, the divergent nature of the movement in Wilson makes for me a fascinating story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wanted you to talk a little bit about the white response to a lot of this activism that begins, as I say. I mean, I think one of the important things about this book is that it shows that there was a lot of movement toward what you call a greater freedom well before what we might call the traditional narrative, well before any Martin Luther Kings were on the scene. The people are acting in the local community. They're forming civic organizations. They're lobbying the city council. They're trying to get, you know, things like sewers put in and roads paved. And there's a wonderful passage in there about water. I can't remember if the guy says something like, well, when one person turns the water on, that means nobody else has it, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah, so these were kind of basic services that they were lobbying for. And I think also it's important to remember that, as you point out, that they were ambivalent about integration. They didn't really know whether they wanted it at the time, that it might not have been a good thing. But I wanted you to talk a little bit about the white response to a lot of this, and you have a very interesting phrase for it. I like the phrase racial diplomacy for these African Americans who kind of go and gently lobby with the white powers that be to do these things. But then you talk about preemptive management. It's very interesting idea. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, what I'm suggesting with the phrase preemptive management, and other scholars have other phrases for it. But what I wanted to contend with, and what I wanted to break down, was this notion that all white responses were functions of massive resistance, right? Were functions of no, hell no, essentially,
yeah.
Right? You know, no, hell no, all the time, every day, all day. By the late probably by the mid 1950s, a number of the more forward thinking officials in Wilson, in the county as well as in Wilson City, sort of see the writing on the wall in terms of segregation. Right, segregation is going to be harder and harder to defend at a time where you know there's an increased number of federal federal dollars that are going to become available to municipalities. For purposes of infrastructure and public housing and economic development, segregation is becoming more and more untenable. And so there's a small nugget of leaders in Wilson who understand that. And so what starts to happen is they engage in what I call preemptive management, which is making small concessions to integration while sort of buttressing segregation in strategic areas, right? So when the sit-ins come to Wilson in 1963, 1964, the city officials, the city council, the city mayor, and the chamber of commerce had been working with a middle-class black organization called the Men's Civic Club to slowly but surely desegregate particular sections of the city. And so what the activists are, and so these middle-class activists are, you know, are very, very excited about their progress, right? You know, this progress is going well. This employment program is going well. Yet and still, right, the vast majority of downtown businesses remain overwhelmingly segregated. The schools in the late 50s, early 60s are still completely and totally segregated. So, but at the same time, you know, this small token desegregation is, and this is great news, right? This is news, you know, that's being shouted from the rooftops, right? The local, you know, the theaters are being desegregated. Yay. You know, the local all white hot dog stand is being desegregated. A&W is being desegregated, right? The county stadium is being desegregated. So, progress and the forces of good, we're marching forward. Right, mm-hmm. Marching on, and things are, you know, things are going well. But at the same time, the city council and the mayor and economic leadership in Wilson are also being very mindful and very diligent in trying to figure out how to maintain these all white spaces in major sectors. Right, and so token desegregation works fine. Right, as long as we're not talking about whole scale desegregation,
mm-hmm.
As long as we're not talking about the integration of schools, right? This token desegregation, one person here, one person there, is fine. And so, as we move into the late 50s and early 60s, preemptive management also means that city fathers, city leadership is not paying a whole lot of attention to issues of infrastructure, mm-hmm. right? Issues of municipal services and things of that nature. The garbage doesn't get picked up on a regular basis in East Wilson. And also in black enclaves around the county, and folks just aren't going to do anything about that, right? Mm-hmm. You know what? This is, see the mayor. Well, we went to see the mayor, and he told us to come see the head of municipal services committee. Well, go see the mayor, go see the committee, right? So they get so another very essential component of preemptive management is the bureaucracy, mm-hmm. right? Is the city, and in some instances the state bureaucracy, which just sort of, has black folk in this maze, right? This habit trail, for those of you out there who know what a habit trail is.
No, I do.
Right. Right. I'm showing my age now. Yeah. Right? 70s baby. So to that end, preemptive management is quite effective, right? Black folks, on the one hand, are celebrating these token inroads, and there is a spirit of change in the air, and there are some larger concessions being made, but when you get right down to it, the structure of segregation and the culture of segregation is still pretty firmly intact in the mid 1960s, mm-hmm. and so the response to that is a growing sort of disenchantment with both white leadership as well as black leadership on the part of working class activists, because they see and understand how their issues have been consistently sort of ignored, right? If you're a middle class black family in Wilson, chances are you live on a street that's paved.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If you're a middle class black family in Wilson, segregation looks a little different to you because of your socioeconomic status. Clearly, there's some areas of mutual, there's some concentric areas, right, in terms of the realities of segregation and white supremacy. But to be poor and working class in the American South in the late 50s and on into the 60s, well, on into the 70s and 80s for that matter, to be poor and working class in these regions is to face another aspect of segregation, mm-hmm. And dislocation that middle class activists just really couldn't fathom or weren't concerned about, right? So, for instance, when issues of housing arise in the late 50s and early 60s, and working class activists are increasingly becoming more and more organized and are starting to organize around, again, issues of municipal services and around issues of dilapidated and substandard housing, this doesn't become a concern, as far as I can tell, this doesn't become an active concern of elite black leadership in Wilson until the mid to late 60s,
hmm.
right? Even though, everyone knows that, 70% of the houses in East Wilson are dilapidated, right? Mm-hmm. 50% of the houses are deemed, unfit for human habitation.
Mm-hmm.
And people are scared about this, right? Who do you complain to about this when your landlord is, when your landlord is one of the richest people in town, or when your landlord is on the city council, when your landlord's on the housing, works at the housing authority or whatever, mm-hmm. or when as a number of people would say, if you went to complain about the fact that, the planks on, the planks that make up your floor have holes in them, and it's letting all your heat out, and you can see the dirt under your house, and it's letting all these rodents in, and all that kind of stuff. If you complain to your landlord about this, your landlord will come, nail a board down under your, nail a board under your floor, and raise your rent by $3
mm-hmm.
a month.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I had a couple of people say, well, I couldn't afford to complain about my dilapidated housing,
mm-hmm.
right? Because that was going to have real and serious consequences for me.
Mm-hmm.
So working class So poor and working class activists are some of the first people in town to figure out that we need a new language. We need a new system with which to confront preemptive management, because the silence of middle class and elite black leadership, particularly again in the areas of municipal services and housing, that silence or that reluctance to act, say working class activists, is killing us.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, our kids get sick. You know, when my kid gets sick, he's got to stay home. If I got to stay home, that means I'm not bringing money home. Mm-hmm. I'm a wage worker, right? So for every day of work, I'm losing money.
Right.
So do I stay home with my kid or not? And the reason my kid is sick is because, well, you know, because the garbage isn't getting picked up on a regular basis. And, you know, what do you mean take him to the doctors and pay for medicine with what? Right. Again, I don't have any cash. I can't do that. Right. I'm uninsured. Right. It's like a current conversation. Right.
Yeah.
And so, working class folk are the ones who are increasingly willing to confront this preemptive management that they see occurring. That's having the effect of sort of neutralizing in some ways, right? Sort of neutralizing elite black leadership.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see. So one of the things I wanted to just discuss very briefly, or at least just mention, is that sometimes this preemptive management was a bit more naked than others. For example, when they abolished the ward system.
Right.
Could you talk a little about that? I just thought that was very cheeky.
Yes. In 1953, G.K. Butterfield, a dentist and community activist, World War I veteran, one of the founding members of the NAACP chapter in Wilson, wins a seat on the city council in 1953, and much to the consternation of white leaders in town. And he is he's reelected in 1955. Again, there's this massive get out the vote effort in the black section of Ward 3. Leaders, city councilmen are elected by wards as a ward system. And Ward 3 was split fairly evenly between white voters and black voters. But Butterfield is able to tie and then ultimately win in 53. And then in 55, black voters simply show up in higher rates than white voters. And so he's reelected. In 1957, the city council votes to dissolve the ward system. And so in 1957, instead of people running for their particular ward, everyone's running at large. And the system basically says, okay, well, the top seven people, the top seven vote getters, there's your city council.
Mm-hmm.
And so Butterfield is the only incumbent to lose his seat.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, this was something that's going on all across the South, right? We see in the 50s and early, we see throughout the 50s and 60s, cities switching from wards to at-large elections. And like Wilson, right, you know, as far as I can tell, the sole purpose of this was to dilute concentrated black votes, you know, block
yep.
vote. Because the other thing that, the other rule that gets changed in Wilson is there's an implementation of a rule called single shot voting. And so what that means is when you go in and vote for a city council, you have to vote for seven people. You can't just go in and vote for one person,
uh-huh.
right? So what does that mean? It means African-American voters in Wilson, you can't just go in and vote for G.K. Butterfield and turn in your ballot.
Right.
If you do that, then your ballot is your ballot is excluded. It's mm-hmm. it's rendered invalid. And so the change to the at-large vote and the change with the implementation of the anti-single shot rule gets Butterfield defeated.
Mm-hmm.
And another activist in town winds up taking this sues the city and takes the case all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court does not hear the case and lets the North Carolina Supreme Court ruling, which said that you can't prove harm here, you can't prove racial intent. So it lets that ruling stand. But this is an example of a fairly naked attempt to disenfranchise a growing African American voting bloc, and throughout both of these elections, the Wilson Daily Times, the newspaper, is printing. You know, they're printing on a regular basis the number of African Americans who are registering to vote. Right? They're saying, like, "Hey, you know what? You know, another 15 Negroes registered. Yeah. Another 20 Negroes registered today. Right? Yeah. Another, you know, uh-huh. you know, like, hey, white folks, heads up.
Yeah,
right?
Right?
You know, Negroes are registering to vote. They're organized, and so again, a fairly naked attempt to try to keep tabs and to keep count, so that white officials could govern themselves accordingly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, talk a little bit about what happens in the 60s when the civil rights movement kind of comes to consciousness to greater America. How does that affect things in Wilson?
Well, I would contend that as we move into the late 60s, there is a convergence of sorts with the movement in Wilson. Working class activists are increasingly becoming involved in the movement in Wilson. And with this increased involvement, there is an increased focus on, again, some of these bread and butter issues that were further down on the list for middle class activists. And so, as the movement becomes nationalized, right, as in 1964 and 1965, with events such as Freedom Summer and Selma March, obviously the March on Washington, as the movement becomes nationalized, there are various constituencies within Wilson trying to make meaning of this movement, trying to figure out what does this national movement mean for us here in Wilson, right? And so, again, white leadership is trying to figure out which areas it should relent, which areas it should sort of bolster its defenses. Middle class African American leadership is continuing to hammer on issues of voting and school desegregation and hiring of African Americans within the economic arena in Wilson. And increasingly, once again, working class activists are becoming more and more organized. They're getting exposed to community activists and community organizers from other portions of the state. Wilson is in dialogue because of a large youth chapter of the NAACP, and because of the activities of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. The SCLC was pretty active in Eastern North Carolina, and as a matter of fact, Milton Fitch, who lives in Wilson in the 50s and 60s. As a letter carrier, Fitch is the state representative for the SCLC, and so Wilson is connected. Wilson is plugged in to a statewide network of activists, and it is connected. And this statewide network of activists, these are activists who are working for and with national organizations. One of the key turning points, I contend, in the book is when working class folk in Wilson bump into an organization called the Foundation for Community Development. This is an organization that was founded in 1967, 1968, that is dedicated to training community activists across the state. But unlike a SNCC model or an SCLC model, these folks have foundation money. They've got money from the North Carolina Fund, which is a Ford Foundation funded initiative. It's one of the precursors to Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty, right? So FCD activists identify Wilson as one of the places where they need to send in some trained activists to work with and help help folks in Wilson sort of institutionalize their social change mechanisms, right? So they send a couple of organizers and they say, look, we're here to help you all. What are your issues? What are your concerns? What are the issues around which we need to be organizing? And of course, overwhelmingly, people are talking about, you know, the municipal issues again and housing. They're also talking about school desegregation. They're also talking about police brutality. Mm-hmm. They're also talking about access to decent jobs and decent wages and things of this nature. And so the kicker is when FCD starts training and organizing working class activists. And so you get the rise of folks like Fannie Corbett, who I talk about extensively in chapter 4, Velma Farmer and this wonderful group of black working class women who come in and say, hey, you know what? It's our time. Right, it's time for us to step to the front, to step to the forefront. We've been trained by this organization that is increasingly starting to contend with the realities of black power and black nationalism. Right, and so activists are coming in and telling these working class women and men, hey, you know what? It's time for us to build our own institutions. It's time for us to confront. To confront white leadership in some different ways. It's time for us to start thinking in terms of ownership. Are you taxpayers? Yes. Well, then this is your city. You pay for this city, right? Your money builds this. Your money built this city. So let's reshape our relationship to city government. Let's reshape our relationship with the city council and with the mayor. Let's go in with the Roberts Rules of Order so that we can understand how to navigate and negotiate the bureaucracy, right? Let's engage the legal and bureaucratic process, right? Let's hire and retain lawyers. Let's go out and take photographs of these, of this dilapidated housing, and go and confront the housing authority and ask them why aren't they enforcing their own laws? Why aren't they enforcing the housing code that they've passed to make sure that everybody in Wilson has a decent place to live and has a decent has access to water and things of this nature? And so, again, this is a process. This is a moment in time where activists in Wilson are definitely have one eye on Wilson, but they're casting another eye out into other parts of other regions of North Carolina, right? Where you see increasingly progressive action on parts of working class, poor and working class folks. So they've got an eye on Durham. They've got an eye on Greensboro. They have an eye on a number of hotspots across the country where working class activists are really starting to come to the fore when it comes to this movement, right? You know, again, the late 60s, early 70s.
I see. So tell us a little bit about we're running out of time, which is too bad because I'm really enjoying hearing you talk. Tell us a little bit about Wilson today. What's it like?
Well, Wilson today is a town that is still sort of trying to answer the question, okay, what happens now that the tobacco industry has transformed itself? They're asking the question, how do we bring in more industry? How do we, how do we retool and remake ourselves? And so there's been some pretty notable inroads in terms of attracting businesses. There's been a transformation of the educational structure where you've got local colleges and particularly local community colleges that are trying to help people to retrain themselves so that they can get back out and get back into the work back into the workforce. You still see a lot of the challenges associated with a transformed economy, and you also see the manifestations of this gap, right? The gap between black unemployment and white unemployment is fairly substantial. Mm-hmm. The gap between the education gap also remains fairly substantial, and so a lot of the challenges A lot of the challenges that were that people were confronting in the 60s and 50s, 60s and 70s, a new generation of Wilsonians, black and white, are continuing to sort of to work on these issues.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, is there a lot of I don't know if you can answer this question. Is there a lot of racial tension today in Wilson?
I think that. The racial tension in Wilson, and I'll speak tentatively here because spent having moved to Memphis, it sort of wrecked my travel plans in terms of getting back. I do notice is sort of a generational difference in terms of how people talk about the challenges, right? So when I do go back and talk to folks who are working in the social service arena or folks who are working in education, they talk about the challenges of post-industrial realities, right? They talk about the challenge again of mechanization and of losing, and of these titanic shifts in structural and economic realities, right? Mm-hmm. And how those shifts, make life hard for, a variety of people.
Mm-hmm.
Older activists, when I go back and talk with them, they have a much they talk about and articulate in a different way what these challenges are like, and they're very explicit in connecting current challenges with the challenges of the 19 associated with the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They will talk about, again, I'm thinking about that, they'll talk in terms of a long civil rights movement.
Yeah.
Right? So so the last time I talked with Fannie Corbett a couple of months ago, she was like, "Yep, you know what? At my church and some other places, it's time for us to start gathering together the men and talking with them about the importance of, taking care of your families, taking care of your kids and being good people, right? Mm-hmm. Being good Christian individuals and stuff." Mm-hmm. And then would turn right around and say, when we were working on, these issues back in the day, right? She was making explicit connections between the work that she starts doing in the mid 60s and the work that she wants to start engaging in 2010, 2011,
uh-huh.
Right? 40 plus years later. And so that's the one thing that I do notice, right? The, uh-huh. the old heads who were around in the 50s and 60s, they say, look, this is just another chapter of the same book, right? Which also ultimately, influenced the title of my own book, right? Greater freedom. I had in mind the phrase, in order to build a more perfect union,
yep.
You never get perfect, mm-hmm. right? You continually strive to become more perfect. Well, you continually strive to attain greater freedom. And that's the spirit that these activists that I talk about in the book, that's the spirit in which they move. That's the spirit in which they function. They were in a constant pursuit of greater freedom.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it's a terrific book. Let me close the interview by asking our traditional final question on New Books in History, and that is, Charles, what the heck are you working on now?
Not a thing, Marshall. No. Actually.
Going to the Bahamas.
That's right. Awkward pause. I'm not working on anything there. Since I live in Memphis now, I've been here for 6 years, and although my book came out last year, I've been torn between continued research in North Carolina and starting up and growing some research roots here in Memphis. And I've bumped into an individual by the name of George Washington Lee. He was an African American Republican political activist.
What a name!
Who lived here in Memphis from the 1920s on through to 1976 until his death in 76. And George Washington Lee is a fascinating figure. He is a black nationalist in the 1920s. He is an ardent capitalist throughout the 1930s and 40s. He is a political activist who is fighting for African American political power in the 1950s and 60s. And one of the culminating events of his life is in 1964, he is purged from the Republican Party at the Republican National Convention. He is a Rockefeller Republican, and so the Goldwater people boot him out. And it is Lee's contention that he is not booted out of the Republican Party because, or at least out of the convention. He is not barred from the convention because of his affiliation with particular Republicans. He is barred because of his race. Mm-hmm. And so I'm becoming increasingly interested in this moment in 1964, because I think it's got something. I think it's got something to tell us about the trajectory of Southern politics, mm-hmm. Particularly Southern politics on the Republican side. So that's what I'm knocking around these days.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like a great project, and I hope we get a chance to talk about it. I want to thank you for three things. One is for writing the book, and the second is for talking with us today, and the third, oddly enough, is mentioning habit trails. I just hadn't thought about that since the 70s. I know I'm going to get emails like, what the heck is that exactly?
Yes,
I don't really
know.
I'm not, just
I
don't like tell anybody. I'm not going to tell anybody if you don't. Yeah.
I like
what they are.
Old school sometimes.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Well, Charles, thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Charles McKinney about his book, Greater Freedom, The Evolution of the Civil Rights Struggle in Wilson, North Carolina. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.